You're listening to the Autism Weekly podcast. Each week we share community voices and bring light to stories that increase awareness, acceptance, equity, access, and inclusion. If you haven't already, subscribe to join the Autism Weekly family. I'm your host, Jeff Skibitsky. This week we're joined by Dr. Bruce Tenor, Vice President at Black Menon Behavior Analysis, BMBA, and Principal at CCIU's Child and Career Development Center since July of 2023. Joining him is Jerron Trotman, a board-certified behavior analyst from Atlanta, Georgia. Jerron is not only a visionary and founder, but also the president of Black Men in Behavior Analysis, an organization that's dedicated to Black men in ABA. Together, they'll be discussing applied behavior analysis, staff training, and curriculum development. Jerron, Bruce, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us on, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
One thing I love to be able to do, just because having a snapshot of who we're talking with and what their backgrounds are and what drove their passion, is it's important for telling the story. And maybe we can start with you, Bruce, and you can give us a little bit of a background of, you know, where your interest came within applied behavior analysis, and then also on being able to empower Black men specifically in behavior analysis.
Well, thank you, Jeff, again, for the opportunity for us to have this dialogue. Well, I started off in the field as a teacher, a special education teacher. I was actually an early childhood teacher. I taught students who were 4 and 5 years old and special education for the autistic support in New Jersey for 10 years. I also taught kindergarten and second grade. So working in an elementary building for over a decade definitely allowed me to gain a lot of information, just not only child development, but also children's behavior. And it wasn't until about 2006 when I went to New Jersey, where I started getting exposed to, you know, the science of applied behavior analysis, and also, more importantly, the verbal behavior piece, working with children with autism. So after I became a teacher, and I was a teacher for 10 years, I decided I was influenced by one of my professors to continue to go into school leadership. I never envisioned being a principal. I actually spent a lot of time in the principal's office as a young child, so I never, you know, envisioned myself doing that. So I decided to take a couple of classes, and I started understanding the impact I can have working with not only just in my own classroom, where I can, you know, control variables, but more importantly, have the impact I can have in a school-wide building. That's when I just said, okay, I'm going to go this route. And then once I did my leadership and I understood, like, wow, like doing your internship hours with the superintendent and principal and getting exposed to so many different avenues of, like, in education and the impact you can have, that allowed me to say, okay, this is what I need to do. Not want to do, but I need to do to really, really support folks. So from there, I got my first position as a school leader in the district I worked for in New Jersey as a 504 coordinator. I got a lot of experience, but then I moved into a supervisor of special education, specifically working with the autism population. So then from there, that's when I said, okay, you know, working with staff and then working with parents and working with the students, I just said, okay, it's time to get my BCBA. So that's when I rolled into classes and I got my BCBA, and I said, okay, this is something that's really, that I feel like I needed, but also too, I think that was something that could help me out in regards to being a leader. I don't want to tell people what I do with the skill set or the repertoire. So I had to make sure that I had the repertoire to go out there and give support, staff training, direct support to students, collaborating with other behavior analysts, and also working with the child directly. So that kind of, you know, impacted me, you know, professionally, just as far as the impact of having a BCBA. So,
yeah, I mean, and that story isn't so atypical. A lot of times it's just kind of almost that that awakening sort of moment, seeing that, you know, these principles of behavior analysis, how powerful they could be implemented within your community, within your school, within just your life in general, and that driving the passion. And now you're able to give back and train others and bring them along. How about yourself, Jerron? What brought you to the field, and where did your passion stem from?
Yeah, thanks again for having us, Jeff. Bruce, every time I hear that story, man, I'm fascinated, because, you know, when I hear about people talk about their stories, particularly as a N2 behavior analysis and BCBA, it's not like, you know, doctors and lawyers and teachers, like we all kind of just find a field. Like we find it, you know, we don't grow up saying, I want to be a BCBA. We just kind of fall into the field. So like my story personally was, I was a Division I college basketball player. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. Didn't know if I want to go overseas, what it entailed. And my college coach's wife knew I was, you know, interested in like, you know, leadership and behaviors. And she just recommended that I go check out this school. And it was a school for autism in New Hampshire. And from there, you know, I kind of really fell in love with the field. So I was able to do 150 plus hours shadowing BCBAs. And that's when I learned about behavior analysis. And I was amazed to learn that behavior could be observed and measured systematically, and that people's lives could literally be improved by applying the science. So from there, I went on to grad school, you know, and it's really been history since. You know, I've been working, and, you know, my interests really entail the teaching and instruction part. And I'm also really interested in the functional assessment and treatment of severe problem behaviors, and behavior analytic consultation to schools. And I'm just kind of starting to get into the OBM space, which Bruce also knows about as well, which is very intriguing to me as well. So the application of the science extends, you know, to a lot of different groups and populations. And I'm just really, I love the science, and I love being able to improve people's lives using the science.
Yeah, you know, it's funny is that we get stuck into those moments where we think that ABA is only specifically for the autistic population or only specifically right. for specific conditions. Yet it's so broad. There's so many applications, and you all have already kind of touched on a few of them as far as, you know, how you can start moving the science along and make it so that it's accessible for many. But before we get into kind of the training and the techniques within the field, I'd love to kind of just hear your perspective, because you represent a group that I feel is underserved in the population as far as trying to be able to create more clinicians. You all are obviously leaders in the field, but those leadership opportunities are not readily available for every single person that's out there. And I want to know, what's the importance from your perspective of having diversity, having representation in the field of ABA, whether that's on standards, quality, decision-making within the field, how it impacts specific communities. And maybe we'll start with you, Jerome, this time. Can you guide me on how to articulate why that's so important?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's something that we've talked about for a while now. I would say, you know, having diversity in the field just makes sure that we have, you know, a wide range of perspective and experiences, and to make sure that cultural backgrounds are represented, right? So, you know, being able to address disparities and access to ABA services. So when you have individuals from diverse backgrounds that are involved in different training and curriculum development, you know, this can better tailor interventions to, I would say, meet the specific needs of underserved and marginalized communities, particularly when we talk. And then this can lead to more equitable outcomes and greater impact for those who need support. But also, I would say, and we talk about this a lot, you know, it helps cultural competence. It helps address biases. So diversity, you know, can help mitigate bias, because when you have those different perspectives and those are considered in the development in your assessments, your interventions, your treatment plans, this can lead to more, you know, objective and effective outcomes for, you know, the clients that we serve. So I would also say that it's not only important for, you know, training and curriculum, but it's essential for our continued growth in our field. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we embrace that diversity and we promote that representation, we create a more inclusive and impactful field, I would say, for behavior analysis.
No, absolutely. And I think that some of the things that we don't always highlight that need to be highlighted is a lot of the research that's been done is on a homogenous population. So even when we're trying to say, hey, you know what, this is how you should be applying ABA, we haven't done enough research to really start to break it out to see how it affects different communities differently. Bruce, yes. I mean, how do you see? Is there anything that you would add to what Jerome was saying?
Absolutely. I just think when you have groups, so you have, like, particularly for our, we talked about African American and what we're doing right now, a marginalized group for such an extensive period of time, you know, with whether it's systemic racism or whether it's going to be the limited resources, you know, coming together, this is an opportunity for us collectively to be responsible for our community and say, we have this science that the purity of the science, right? We look at the non-bias, the people are biased, not the science. The science is the science. And we have an opportunity to represent our community and utilize this science to enhance the repertoires of the people in the community to ensure that we are giving ourselves, or we are, you know, supporting each other and giving us the resource for us to excel in what we need to do. And I think that's what this, the BNBA is for. It's like, hey, how can we have folks, not many, but the folks that we have, how can we collectively come together? How do we continue to train, support, shape responses so we can enhance what we do? So now we can be, as far as a community, collective community, we can provide more for our community using the science to enhance all areas, not just autism or not just specific things in school, but everywhere, school, in your home, it could be in the community, looking at supports and services, the prison system, anything that's a detriment to the growth and enhancement of a particular group, the science can help support that. So I think that's what I look at this, and we discuss all the time what the purpose of this is, and this is what it is about.
And I definitely appreciate that perspective and the way that you all were able to kind of put that out there. It layers on to, you know, why this should be a priority for organizations on how to be able to create more opportunity and more voice for leadership within those positions. But I'd like to kind of pivot back to the science. You all have mentioned kind of the science of ABA, and you both have very different experiences with it. And that's what I'd love to kind of put into perspective right now is that, Dr. Tenor, your background has a lot of extensive experience in special education. When we're talking about something like a discrete trial for being able to teach some common skills or some new behaviors, is that oftentimes you're thinking of this in a one-on-one environment, a clinical environment. How does that translate? How does that work within a school district so that you can start to build more discrete trial opportunities and maybe create systems so that it becomes more normalized within that environment?
Absolutely. So for us, in the state of Pennsylvania, we have programs called autistic support. And in the public school, you know, the law says that you can have a max full-time caseload for full-time children who are in the spectrum in a classroom for 8 students within a classroom. So in there, when we look at discrete trial training, obviously we know it's an evidence-based instructional methodology that's proven to be effective. For discrete trial, you know, we do run intensive teaching or discrete trial trainings for our children that are on the spectrum that requires that level of intensity but you know, we make it very clear in our program, what is discrete trial? What is the purpose of discrete trial? You're creating this artificial environment where you are trying to establish instructional control. You know, you have a lot of your reinforcers set and you're building so many skills. But the most important part for discrete trial training, which is a very critical aspect of what we do in our program, we have to make sure that is the maintenance and the generalization. And I think that is where we have to connect the discrete, like, hey, it's okay to tack certain common items or tack parts of an item, but if you can only tack these items or man particular items in your seat in the corner working one-on-one, then it's kind of like irrelevant in the sense of like, okay, that's good, I can do with this person. Am I able to generalize with different folks, different environments, and different items that are similar common stimuli that may look like a cookie, but we can't generalize those skills, then, you know, we're not doing our job. So although discrete trial training is done in our programs and we do utilize that teaching instructional methodology, which is effective, but the biggest thing is we have to ensure generalization and maintenance, making sure that what I'm working on at this table has to be able to go and generalize in a natural environment setting or something that's not common to your area. And I think that conversation with our staff is being had, has been had and discussed numerous times. And I think that understanding of, you know, how it looks. And also, too, I always say, too, for discrete trial, you know, we always look at it from like, hey, you're sitting down and the old school Lovas way of doing it and the intensive trials. And obviously, yes, it is some intensive teaching, but, you know, that can look differently too. So intensive teaching can be done in different locations. It doesn't have to be sitting down in a corner, you know, with the staff one-on-one, although that looks like it for certain learners that may need that, but it can be done in other aspects too for discrete trial. You know, it's just, again, it's an intensive teaching methodology that requires a lot of reinforcement, a lot of stimulus control that needs to be done, but that could be done standing up, sitting down, different environments that you can teach this skill. And then the goal is to generalize the skill and make sure it has maintenance over time.
No, absolutely. Oftentimes I feel like clinicians get stuck is that they go and teach a skill, don't teach how to be able to generalize, how to be able to utilize the skill across a variety of different environments and people like you described. And then it's almost like, well, what did we teach? How did we offer anything to this learner? And maybe, Jaron, this goes into the individualization. And maybe this goes into how you tailor training and how you tailor curriculum so that it's truly individualized so that you can take a technique like a discrete trial. You can take a technique that might be differential reinforcement, but apply it so that it's unique for that person and that people are trained to do that. How's that process go?
Yeah, and Bruce, you hit some great points, brother, when you spoke about generalization and maintenance. And when you talked about discrete trial instruction, you know, a lot of people see that as being synonymous with what ABA is. They think that discrete trial instruction is what ABA is. So, you know, for our listeners, when we're talking about tailoring our ABA program, like we have to tailor our programs, particularly with individual behavioral and emotional disorders. And this involves a comprehensive and individualized approach. So taking it from the beginning, it starts with a thorough assessment. We have to identify the needs of the strengths and the challenges of the learner. And this includes things like interviews, observations, standardized assessments. But based off of those behavior analysts, we then can develop a treatment plan that's tailored to that individual learner. You know, so if you're running a cookie cutter program and you just pull them from a bank, you know, that's not going to be as effective, right? So we have to have clear and measurable goals that are based off the principles of behavior analysis, right? So in that, we have specific strategies and interventions that are designed to address the unique challenges, right? So through our implementation, you know, through these tailored programs, you know, then we want to continuously monitor the progress and make those adjustments as needed, right? So modifying goals, changing strategies, providing additional supports for a learner to succeed. So in addition to, I would say, individual programming, we want to collaborate with other professionals and caregivers. That's essential because this ensures that the learner or client's needs are being addressed comprehensively and that everybody involved is working towards the same goals, I would say.
So, I mean, you both have really hit on that generalization component, and it almost rings a bell immediately to the fact that when you are generalizing, when you are creating curriculum, doing an effective ecological assessment, understanding what variables actually exist, what skills are actually useful for that particular child in those environments. I remember stories about, you know, teaching a crosswalk sign, yet that crosswalk sign doesn't even exist in the community. And it's like, what in the world did you just teach? Is that you're teaching to a stimulus or a stimuli, but you're not necessarily teaching anything functional. So, Bruce, how important is it to understand who your client is? What their perspective and worldview is, what their community looks like in order to provide appropriate intervention?
Well, I work in an education setting, so we talk about IEP, the first acronyms, individualized. So you have to make sure you individualize. So obviously it's going, here's two things very critical. One, you got to do an assessment. There's different type of assessments. We all know there's preference assessments you can use to identify reinforcers for the child. But the most critical aspect of this, especially when you're looking at learners who are of age at the middle school and high school, you know, we have to ensure that we talk to the families and bring the families in there, because we got to understand what's of value for the family. These families are held to take care of their child. And depending on what state you are in, every state's different. After, you know, 21 years old, you know, the social service or the adult service systems are totally different in many states as far as their limited resources. So many families are stuck, you know, in a position where they have these children, they had their child with them. And although they love their child, you know, what skill repertoire did we help support so they can be more independent? And I think the most critical thing I would say, like you look at the continuum of service, right? At the elementary level, you are intensifying your discrete trial training to ensure that you are acquiring as many mans as you can. You're enhancing your tech repertoire. Hopefully, you can transition to the introverbals, get into social skill, the social aspect, aspect enhanced. But when you get to a certain age, when maybe those repertoires are not as enhanced as you like, we're still going to work on those skills, which is very critical. However, we need to start teaching and very clear for staff, understanding like what in the environment are the repertoires that are going to be needed to be successful, to be as independent as possible, such as, and I'm big on this, toilet training. I think schools a better job collectively, and I'm being honest, of a lot of teaching children how to use the bathroom independently. I think it's a daunting task. I know behavior analysts and parents and families are working really hard. You know, no one wants their child to be, you know, in teens in a diaper, but we collectively as analysts have to just be better at just helping these families, ensuring that we can do these little things such as toilet training and other things too. Like we have to be able to help support children basic preliminary skills, like teaching them how to wait. Like those are critical skills. Family sometimes, and I've dealt with families for over two decades, you know, working with them. I started initiatives with family initiatives in my old position when I was a supervisor for office support, you know, and we had so many amazing conversations. And a lot of the conversations that we discussed were just like, what are the skills when you get older? You know, what are the independent skills that are needed? So I just think we have to just make sure that we're just aware of the little skills, like, hey, they can't even take their child out to Burger King because they can't wait. But we have to teach them how to wait because that's a critical skill. Families deserve the right to take their families out to dinner. If they feel they can't do that, then it's very unfortunate that they can't even go out to dinner, that they get a sitter because this child can't wait, you know, or the line's very long and you say, wait, well, we have to wait because, you know, we can't get upset and have problem behaviors when there's two, three people in front of us. So like these little things come here, stop. They have to understand these little compliance because when you're at the stop sign, if you don't stop or you're at the crosswalk, that can be very dangerous. So I just think it's very important that we teach important skills that can impact their everyday life as they get older or as they move into adulthood. Very critical.
Yeah. And I think that starts young. I think that I do think that you have to start prioritizing some of those skills at different points for different individuals, just knowing, you know, what's going to empower them at the moment. I love the fact that you mentioned is that you got to bring the family along with you. They have to have a voice in the process, because if they don't, you're not going to make headway. Your prognosis for success is extremely low because you're not working on common goals. But when we're talking about the individualization, and I'm thinking through this, and you went through and you were able to highlight the importance of specific critical skills, but if you're not individualizing techniques, I would imagine is that that's one of the biggest risks for intensifying behavior as it goes on, and creating more severe, more traumatizing behavior for the individual and for the family. So, Jerron, I know that you mentioned that you have a passion within functional analysis and functional behavior assessments, is that how do you make sure that you take some of those concepts Bruce is talking about of individualizing, making sure that it's applicable, making sure that you're bringing in all the people that are involved in that child's life to the decision-making process as you're creating behavior plans to avoid severe behavior or just start to reduce it if it does occur?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I just want to quickly echo those sentiments that both of you gentlemen just said, you know, particularly in terms of the collaborative part. And I don't think we talk about that enough when we as behavior analysts about, you know, trying to make change, trying to make headway. We have to include the big stakeholders, the teachers, the parents, like all those people need to be included to be effective. You know, when we talk about a comprehensive approach, you know, for severe problem behaviors, you know, the science and the literature, the gold standard is making sure that we are individualizing our understanding of why that behavior is happening. And in behavior analysis, we call that a functional behavior assessment. So making sure that we're conducting a thorough assessment to determine why that behavior is happening. And that's crucial for developing effective interventions. You know, without that, we're just kind of just throwing interventions out and, you know, hoping that it sticks, right? And so when we talk about after that FBA, you know, we can develop a behavior plan. And that behavior plan is going to be a document that has things like, how do we prevent the behavior from occurring? How can we reduce those triggers, right? Changing the setting, altering the task demands, providing more support. These are all things that we can do to prevent those behaviors from occurring. And then we want to teach replacement behaviors, right? So we have to teach the client, the kid, the individual, those alternative behaviors that serve the same function as the problem behavior, right? And these behaviors should be more appropriate and they should be more functional, right? So when Bruce was referencing even this toilet training, things of that nature, we want to teach more appropriate and functional ways to get that done, you know? So, and then positive reinforcement. We can't say that enough. So we have to include positive reinforcement because this is basically a consequence that's going to increase the behaviors that we do want to see, right? And in behavior analysis, we really pride ourselves on collecting data and making sure that the interventions that we're using are effective to track the progress. So these are all things that we want to look about. Bruce talked about safety. Safety is a huge one. So when we're talking about severe problem behavior, especially, we in behavior analysis, we have to try to do no harm. Right. So we want to individualize these approaches, but we want to be in accordance with best practices and ethical guidelines when we're talking about treating those behaviors as well. And then I would say, again, to Bruce's point, generalization and maintenance. All right. So all this stuff is good and great. But if we don't have generalization and maintenance, we have to ensure that these clients, our individuals, can learn these behaviors across a variety of settings, a variety of stimuli over a period of time. So all those things are important, particularly when we talk about individualizing and focusing on problem behaviors.
No, and I mean, I echo exactly what you just said. I think that every part of that is so important in being able to help, to be able to target and to be able to provide appropriate care, is that you have to modify with that as you're moving on. And it's got to be a flexible plan. Yes. One of the things that I think that I'd love to be able to explore with you both a little bit more is that, I mean, we've talked a lot about the techniques, which are pretty universal. We've talked a lot about the science and the research, which are very universal. But I think one of the things that we're missing out on is the fact that our field probably didn't give enough emphasis or enough justice to the fact that we are still working with individuals, which means inclusivity, cultural competence, being able to make sure that there's representation in guiding some of the perspectives in programming, in talking with families and understanding their cultural perspective on your decision making. All of that is so important. So, Bruce, just knowing that you're so involved with Black Men and Behavior Analysis, which is one group that's kind of creating more opportunity, more dialogue, and empowering the Black men in this particular instance, but it's empowering an underserved population. How do you see the future of ABA evolving over time and starting to fill some of these gaps that we might have had in applying our science?
I think organizations like what we're doing right now with BMBA, I think, again, you're going to have various factions of folks with diverse backgrounds that are the minority to the majority. And I just think if we can like platforms like this, you know, and other platforms that sharing what we're doing to show that this science and allowing people and folks like ourselves and others to have a seat at the table, to make decisions, to be on representing different boards, you know, whether it's an organization that's targeted for African Americans or if it's other folks of color and other boards to have a voice at the table to allow to give different perspectives. I think that's the first step is just number one is just the awareness of cultural competency. Like, hey, we got to do better. How do we make this more inclusive? And then, like I say, it's just given the opportunity. It's all about opportunity. And everything you see systemically in life is just about, are certain demographics of folks have the opportunity to do certain things or allowed to extend themselves beyond what they can do to get opportunity. And I think if you give us the opportunity to go out there and talk about issues, be put in positions to have the leadership ability and the cachet, so to speak, to make decisions on behalf of a group or marginalized group, that's where you're going to start seeing the changes. So I just think it's just not only just talking about it, which is first step, you know, hit the gauge of your own verbal behavior, but also too is now let's put into action. Let's bring you to the table. Let's give you the platform and talk about it. Let's support with your resources to give you what you need to get your vision, your mission moving. I think that's where we are. I think continue these conversations like these.
Yeah. And I mean, Jerron, what are the next steps? I mean, right now is that the platform is being built. It's baby steps. I mean, honestly, when I look at what's out there, you mentioned kind of, you know, participation on boards and being maybe even leaders of those boards that are guiding others to decision making versus just being representatives, is that it's not a level playing field at the moment. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who probably deserve more opportunities to be able to kind of give some guidance and knowledge to the field that maybe just don't have that platform yet. So what's the next step? I mean, I think you mentioned to me is that you're going to be having a conference, but I mean, what's the step for outreach to make sure that, you know, that other organizations are seeing the value and making sure that they're applying it within their own field, organization, or discipline?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. You know, and just for perspective, so when me and Bruce met, Bruce, I want to say that I might have been the first Black male behavior analyst you met in person, right? I think that's true. So and I didn't meet my first another Black male BCB until I moved to Atlanta. And at that point, I had been in the field for about 6 years, if that gives you any perspective of representation. So as you know, Jeff, in behavior analysis, we like to do something that's called a task analysis, right? And task analysis is just taking one big goal and we're breaking it out into achievable steps, you know? So to answer your question more directly, you know, that's kind of what we've done and with BMBA. So to Bruce's point, the first thing is, you know, our role behavior, improving that, you know, we wanted to basically establish ourselves, our community, first and foremost. Wanted to increase our social media presence, which we're doing. I'm not sure how you found us, but we've really been trying to branch out and reach out into the community in that way. And then our next step was to develop an executive board so that we can make sure that we are aligning with our mission and our vision for BMBA. Then for us, we want to take care of the community, get membership going. And you know, it starts with also like Bruce, to Bruce's point, like having those opportunities. So even you providing a platform like this of getting the word out to those organizations, the first is kind of letting them know what we're doing, how we're doing it, how they can get involved, how they can support, also providing the blueprint for other people to continue to do this as well. So, you know, at BMBA, we're really working to expand the conversation around diversity. You know, we're trying to provide resources and support and mentorship for behavior analysts with underrepresented backgrounds. So, you know, we're really working to create that inclusive and culturally competent field. So I do want to speak on one key aspect in evolution of BMBA is as our recognition of cultural competence is understanding the impact of culture on behavior, right? And this means that we as behavior analysts need to be equipped with the knowledge and skills to address the unique cultural factors that influence our clients. So, you know, we're continuing to engage in a lot of initiatives, panel discussions. You know, we were just at the last conference with Black Women in Behavior Analysis, continuing to show our representation and inclusion. So, you know, we're engaging a lot of those things right now to make sure that we're getting BMBA out there and then creating those actionable steps to make sure not only our community, but the ABA community in general can know about us and continue to engage in these conversations with us and help support our initiatives.
No, and I appreciate everything that you guys have done so far. And there's still so much work to be done, but it's not just something that you should be carrying on your own. We all should be kind of looking and saying, what's the value of being able to create a more diverse work field and a more diverse science to be able to meet the perspectives and the experience of everybody that's being served? And that requires a larger leadership field. So what advice would you give to behavior analysts that are out there, or entrepreneurs who are behavior analysts that are looking to start their own organizations, or people that are in school right now that are heavily involved in maybe psychology or education? And what would you be telling them about the value, the opportunities out there working with diverse populations, challenging behaviors, and supporting communities?
For aspiring behavior analysts, I would say, prioritize, competence and humility. It's essential to understand and respect diverse backgrounds and experiences. With challenging behaviors, I would say just make sure you have empathy and a non-judgmental attitude. While we try to understand the function of behavior, we have to make sure that we have a non-judgmental attitude as well. I think Bruce, mentioned this earlier, but, build those strong relationships as well. Truly connect with the clients, connect with the families. And I personally take a strength-based mindset. So I try to recognize the strengths and abilities of, individuals that we work with. I'm trying to think of something outside the box here. Pay attention to your self-care, right? So don't underestimate the power of working in this field. It can sometimes be emotionally demanding. So it's important to prioritize your own well-being because burnout is a real thing that, we're talking about right now as you go through pretty much all these conferences. And just make sure you have ongoing professional development and have diverse experiences in your clinical training. I think that's important so that you don't have this one mindset. It's important to, have multiple supervisors as you're coming up in this field as well. So those are a few things that I would tell people coming up in the field or, people who are interested in becoming a behavior analyst.
Excellent. Bruce? I'll piggyback. Newly minted behavior analyst advice I can give is ensuring that you find yourself a strong, not only supervisor, but a mentor. You iron sharpen iron, and you have to ensure that you are going to be around either one or several individuals that can challenge you and help support you throughout your journey. And not just with, clients, but which is very important, but maybe other aspects that you might be going through that can help you walk you through from that aspect. So making sure that you just find that supervisor or mentor that can really help guide you and stay at it, like call them, contact them, be a nuisance. It's okay. It just allows you to just stay sharp being around people who just really are really experienced. And the question you had about maladaptive behaviors or problem behaviors, a couple things. One, I'm gonna go back to my first point. If you are dealing with challenging behavior, definitely. If you are, you do your process, you talk to your team, and you have a conversation. But if you are stuck as a behavior analyst, which at times you may, and you may experience that, you reach out to your mentor, your supervisor, you have those conversations about what to do to really help you out. Because sometimes there are, you have a students whose learning history, their problem behaviors are so intense, or their learning history is so long that it's very challenging to place some problem behaviors on extinction. So what do? And you're in a school setting. And, so you have to make sure that you have that individual and that team to help support you. And also to ensure that you stay abreast and afloat with the literature. The literature is the literature. So there's a lot of excellent, I know we go through, the task list, and we know what DRA, and we know what the differential reinforcement, but make sure you stay in the literature, like read journal articles, watch presentations, go to conferences. I think Jerron did mention about professional development, but just sometimes if you can't go to a PD, which is fine, just immerse yourself in the literature, because some good quality stuff on experimental designs for certain problem behaviors that you're going through that the literature has. So I think it's very good that behavior analysts continue to practice that to stay, stay sharp and see what the literature says, and just ensuring that you just catch everything you can. So that's mine.
Yeah. If I may, I'll go ahead, Jeff. I was to quickly piggyback off of that, because I can't stress one of those points that you made enough, Bruce, about not only about mentorship, about finding your squad, finding your, the brotherhood, finding your team, your community, man. That has been a game changer for me, for being in this field for so long. When I found my mentor, then I found my team, not only to bounce ideas off of to empower me, to provide support, like Bruce said, both professionally, but also personally as well. He talked about supervision versus mentorship and or both, but that mentorship piece is so crucial, particularly as you're coming up in the field. Quickly, when I was coming up, when I first became a BCBA, they would call us junior BCBAs. And I would kind of like, look at my, like, why are you, I got my credentials. Why are you calling me a junior BCBA? This is the place that I worked at. But I, now that I've been here, I understand what that means, because when you're first coming up, to Bruce's point, that task list is the minimum of what you may need to know. And having that mentor and that community and that team to help guide you, particularly early on as you come along, is crucial. It's critical. So great points, Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, you both hit it right on the head, is that, I mean, we're in an ever-evolving field. If you're not staying up on the literature, you're not staying up on what's current, is that you've fallen behind. And that's part of the challenge that we all have to put on each other. But I'd also like to weigh in on the mentorship piece as well, is that one of the joys that I have of hosting this podcast is that I get to talk to so many people who know more about given subjects than I could ever know. And I feel like mentorship, no longer, regardless how long you've been in the field, is something that you need to continue to maintain. Nobody's all knowing in this field in any regard. And the fact that you always have somebody that you can be able to reach out to, a colleague to be able to discuss things with, to continue to improve your clinical skills or your leadership skills, I think is so important. So where can people hear more or find out more about BNBA? Jaron, is there a place that we should be looking?
Yeah, so you can find us in a few places. Our website, bnbanetwork.org. You can find us on Instagram. We're at Black Men in ABA. We're also very active on LinkedIn, so you can support us there. It's Black Men in Behavior Analysis. We also have a Facebook page as well, so it's also Black Men in Behavior Analysis. And if you want to contact us with any questions or anything like that, you can email at contact@bnbanetwork.org. So you can find us in a lot of places. We stay active. We will respond to you. You have any, you know, you want to reach out, spread the word about what we're doing, where we're at, you can find us on all those platforms.
And Bruce, I mean, to add on that, you're heading out to go present at the end of the week. Yeah. So I want to make sure that people understand that they have the opportunity to hear you talk about a really cool subject as well. Can you give us a little bit of a tester or
fielder? A little trailer, right? No, I'm going to be speaking, and I was, humbled and blessed to be invited to be a vice speaker at OABA, which is Ohio, the state for applied behavior analyst. And I'll be presenting two presentations. First one's going to be kind of, and I love the way they did the platform and their the venue. So it's going to be targeting actually as my professional journey as a behavior analyst and how the impact it has on me professionally as a school leader, as a behavior analyst, and the things I've done, within my career to really help, my agencies and children and families and parents overall excel. So I'll be sharing that. And the second one's going to be more personally, how has being a behavior analyst kind of shaped me as a person on a professional, and not only that, but on a personal level too. So I will be referencing from a personal level BNBA, because that allowed me to really challenge me, meeting Brother Jaron, and I can't say enough about Jaron Sharma. He's amazing. He's young, energetic. I'm a very intense and a very passionate individual. And Jaron, I have to like peel him back, because the vision he wants to do and the things he wants to roll out. And I have to just, ream him in, because he is just, so passionate and kind of inspires, continues to inspire me to just, hey, like he's trying to push the field. He's trying to push what we're doing more. So I'm going to talk about that too, and just kind of the impact of how that affected me personally, being a part of BNBA and what it means, and share that information with folks to understand that when you are not only professionally in your day-to-day job, but, being a behavior analyst, how can it impact you, personally, joining boards, being a part of, different organizations and signing up. That stuff is so important personally. So I'm going to share that information with the crowd. It's a little bit of a trailer.
Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you all sharing your story, your knowledge, and your passion with us here on the podcast today. And hopefully we'll be able to kind of continue and maybe have some further discussions later on throughout the year.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Autism Weekly. We hope you tune back in next week to learn more about autism in the real world. Autism Weekly is now found on all the major listening apps, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more.
Subscribe to be notified when we post a new podcast. Autism Weekly is produced by ABS Kids. ABS Kids is proud to provide diagnostic assessments and ABA therapy to children with developmental delays like autism spectrum disorder. You can learn more about ABS Kids and the Autism Weekly podcast by visiting abskids.com. Thanks for tuning in. See you again next week.